It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Well, welcome to today's Capital Thinking Show with Pat and Boggs. Actually, you're hearing from Mike Diener today. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor from our Pat and Boggs Denver office, and I'm guest hosting the show in place of my Washington colleague, Kevin O'Neill, today. As I mentioned, I'm coming to you from Denver, Colorado, where the summer is beginning to wane a little bit, but they predict 100-degree-plus temperatures here, and the ski season is not too far off, a couple months away, but our first guest today is coming from Texas, where I know the temperature mark down there is nothing to compare to what others have been experiencing. You guys are way above the 100-degree mark all the time, isn't that correct?
Yeah, we are for at least the last 60 days, at least.
That's crazy. Well, as you heard, Mark Bennett is my first guest today. Mark, his practice is serving as an outside general counsel for numerous companies, and handling complex litigation, bankruptcy, and workout-related matters for clients in various industries, including some major energy companies. Mark, welcome today.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're in a nice, cool place while you're talking.
Yeah, you know, in Texas, it's four walls and an air condition these days. You try to stay away from outside as much as you can.
Well, I hope you get out of there soon enough. Tell me a little bit about your in-house experience working with corporations and now being an attorney for them. What's the difference between actually working in-house and then working from the outside?
You know, it's funny. My experience was with Texaco. I got recruited to go there a while back. Was there roughly about 2.5 years. And then had the pleasure of going through the Chevron merger and getting to decide to stay in Texas or move to California. And I decided to stay in Texas. And when I went outside, I decided that my years in-house kind of developed a practice set that was marketable to kind of your mid-range companies that were big enough to need in-house legal but didn't necessarily have them. So I kind of started to market myself as that outside general counsel, if you would, that kind of gets to know the company just as if you were an in-house counsel. And it's funny that model has just kind of exploded and allowed me to use the in-house experiences that I got at Texaco and the things that they taught me there in major oil to use on the outside as an outside GC.
Are there, when you look at attorneys such as yourself who work for corporate clients, are a lot of them folks who have had the experience you've had, or has it been your view that a lot of people kind of come out of law school, get in a law firm, and then try to do corporate work?
You know, I've actually done my career backwards. Most people come out of law school, get your law firm experience, and then go in-house.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of came out of law school, started out in a small firm in East Texas, which was more of a general practice, which really kind of prepared me for the in-house role. Went in-house, and now I've been on the outside for a while. And it kind of brings a unique perspective, especially when I'm dealing with companies that actually have in-house legal counsel. And we kind of I work almost as a, not necessarily just as an outside counsel to them, but almost kind of as a confidant, if you will, based upon the experiences that I've developed over the years through my in-house experience.
I've heard most in-house counsel these days are much, are much more than just lawyers. I mean, I'm one of my friends who worked for a healthcare client. He had a senior C title. So he, had management and strategic duties too. Do you the same thing in your role when you're helping your corporate clients?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. You know, the one joke that I have, I give a lot of presentations across the country, and one of the jokes I always have for in-house groups is what is your actual job? You spend half your day, I would say at least, as an in-house attorney these days, giving business advice. Lawyers are being hired across the country not to just be counsel, but to be vice presidents of different departments, C-level executives, you name it. And as an outside GC, what I have found is I kind of have that same role a lot of the times. I mean, a lot of the phone calls, a lot of the questions are more business decision related than they are legal related. And sometimes that role gets a little bit of fuzzy, if you will. So the best thing that I can do for my clients is I've got to keep up not only with the legal side but also the business side. And if you don't, then doing what I do, you can't evolve as the in-house role of counsel has evolved over the years.
So would you say that you advertise yourself as more of a generalist in how you approach things?
Yeah, that's the strange thing. You know, most law firms these days are marketing themselves as the specialist in particular areas. I market myself, it's kind of funny, as the generalist specialist.
How do people receive that? Because everybody seems to, like you say, they seem to look for the specialist or the one with specific expertise. And, you know, I think of myself as a generalist, too, in terms of what I do from the public policy standpoint. But, you know, sometimes that's open to criticism.
Yeah, it is. And it is, you know, most people, when they first meet me, it's kind of that taken aback type approach. But really what it does is my general approach to things allows me to have experiences in a lot of different areas, and I can provide input into different legal issues and different business issues that may come up on a day-to-day basis. One of the things I always tell all my clients is, you know, I will be your first stop, but I'm not dumb enough to think that I have all the answers. And one of the great things about working for a law firm that has full service capabilities is that if I can't get to the solution, there's definitely somebody here who can, but I'm more of the confidant, if you will, or the first stop. But with my experiences of being able to basically answer, you know, questions from the beginning of a corporation to what happens in the middle of the corporation to, as you mentioned in my early bio, even doing the bankruptcy, which, you know, the last couple of years has been more useful than it has in previous times. That's kind of how it's all developed.
Well, and do you have access beyond the general counsel when you work with corporations? Do you work with the C-level suite and interact with them on their strategic development?
Absolutely. I give speeches all the time on team building and how to put together their different business models, strategies, marketing. You know, it's funny because a lot of my in-house experience, I dealt with the different business units, and it's similar to what the, you know, in-house counsel community is doing now. They're being brought in not necessarily to just be the lawyers, but to also kind of be the business leaders to help the C-level suite to basically get ideas, think outside the box. You know, one of the great things about law school is it doesn't just teach you about law. It teaches you a different way to think. And people that haven't been through that experience don't appreciate or understand the importance that can have in developing business strategies for clients.
Now you have a litigation background, and a lot of times people come with preconceived notions of litigators as sort of hard-nosed, aggressive, difficult people to deal with. I mean, do you find that to be a challenge sometimes when people know that you've practiced litigation?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, you know, but one of the things I learned when I was with Texaco, which I thought was unique, was that when we were drafting contracts or negotiating deals, they always wanted the litigators to review those contracts before they went out. The real reason was to make sure that there wasn't any what we call loose language or empty phrases or, you know, paragraphs correlated with one another. And what I found through that experience at Texaco, and I've kind of developed through the years, is that as a litigator, I can actually see what the end game is on a business deal. If this goes wrong, I can tell the client what he's looking at the end. And with that perspective, what I basically tell them is sometimes the best negotiators you can have in a business deal is a litigator because, you know, you really hope everything goes well and everyone does exactly what they say they're going to do and everyone makes money and everyone's happy. But reality is in the business world, that's not always what happens. So as a litigator, I can actually prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And that most clients, once they get past that initial impression of shouldn't you be a corporate guy, find that it's actually beneficial to have that advice on the front end. And the other thing that I've kind of changed in my own practice is I have a tendency to take a very much a business approach early on in disputes as opposed to a pure litigator mind of, I'll see you on the steps of the courthouse if we can get this resolved.
I was with the new dean of the University of Colorado Law School the other day, and he's, trying to think about how they do things differently. I mean, what advice would you have for a law school dean as it relates to, what you do now and how that kind of evolved?
You know, the best advice I can give is, for years, in most law schools, they've basically pushed the same theory that most law firms have, which is you have to specialize. You got to pick a specialty. Take your general classes in your first year. Second year, you kind of focus on things that you like. In your third year, you're focusing in on the area that you want to practice for the rest of your life. That's always kind of been contrary to my belief system, because I kind of think that, as you develop as a lawyer and as you develop as a person, your likes, dislikes, and experiences will change your perspective on this practice. I mean, there's a reason why we call it a practice. It's never ending. as a result, what I have found is that I started out as, a pure litigator. That's all I did. What I found was most of my clients weren't necessarily happy at the end of the day. They either, were upset that they lost, or they were upset that they won but had to pay money to get to where they thought they should have been, a year ago. As a result, I found the corporate guys always had happy clients because they were always doing the deals. So, I mean, it's kind of like I wanted happy clients, not upset clients, so I kind of gravitated to that. And then I found, labor clients have the best stories, so, I gravitated to that. And what I ended up finding was my practice was better, and I was a better lawyer for my clients by doing a little bit of everything as opposed to specializing on any single one thing. So, I mean, my best advice to law schools is to not necessarily adopt the old model of, you have to have that one specialty, but maybe focus on providing some classes and things that may even have a little bit more of a business twist to them, which is a more realistic approach to what clients are expecting now from lawyers. There's more than just legal service expected now when you're hired by your corporations.
Well, Mark, this has been great to get a chance to chat with you. It sounds like you have a very dynamic practice, and I know you're very busy with it, so I hope the heat doesn't impede you from being successful down there. Thanks for joining us today on our Pat and Boggs show, Capital Thinking.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care, Mark.
All righty.
Well, we'll be back shortly for our next segment on Capital Thinking. Thank you.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on. Football.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye.
The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Well, welcome back to Capital Thinking. This is Mike Dino from Patton Boggs' Denver office today. I'm guest hosting for my colleague Kevin O'Neill, who actually was out here in Denver yesterday. We had a big event for one of our clients. The Regional Transportation District was able to announce a billion-dollar grant from the Federal Transit Administration to build our rail system that will connect downtown with the airport. And hopefully in about 5 years, for those out there who will be visiting Denver, be able to take a train in from the airport into downtown, which will be very exciting for all of us. My next segment is with Sam Israel. Sam is an attorney who handles a variety of litigation matters, commercial litigation matters, with a particular emphasis on bankruptcy litigation. Sam, thanks for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, we're glad to have you, and we're going to learn a little bit about how you handle bankruptcy issues. You recently had a jury trial. This is very unique, as I understand. I'm not an attorney. I handle public policy matters for Patton Boggs, but you had a jury trial in a bankruptcy case, and they're pretty rare. Tell us why.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it was a great opportunity, great experience. You know, normally most disputes are litigated in the bankruptcy area, are litigated before bankruptcy judges, who are, you know, and they're typically bench trials. There are rare opportunities, although they're becoming more common, hopefully, to have a jury trial. About 20 years ago, in fact, the Supreme Court in the Grand Financier case essentially said that there was a Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial in certain instances involving bankruptcy causes of action, particularly fraudulent transfers. However, not many folks took advantage of that. Our situation, the defendant actually asked for a jury trial. Ironically enough, we fought it. Turned out to be one of the best things for us, because we were successful and able to convince the jurors in a forum that we were not from, in the Virgin Islands in St. Thomas, to go our way. So it was a particularly rare opportunity. The other very interesting part of it was that we actually tried the case to two juries, which is even more rare, because there were two separate.
And was that by design? Did you think you'd have to go to two juries, or did it, you know, one come after the other, without planning for the second?
No, actually, we were very surprised. We had thought these were two consolidated cases brought by two separate trustees. We represented one of the trustees who was a trustee for an individual in bankruptcy. The other trustee represented his company. And we thought once they consolidated them that we would try it to one jury. We were very surprised about 2 weeks before the case, when the court said, no, we're going to try to two juries. And in fact, the district judge who tried the case expressed to us that it was the first time, and he's been on the bench for many, many years, that he tried two juries. So it was a unique experience all around.
And when you mention the judge, I mean, usually a bankruptcy claim goes before a judge, right?
That's true. And again, there are rare occasions when you have the opportunity to, as either mostly as a defendant who's being sued either by a debtor or has a dispute with the debtor or a trustee or the like, to seek to have the case heard, usually in a district court, as opposed to the bankruptcy court, and in that situation can seek a jury trial. So, for example, I don't know if they've sought one yet, but I don't know if you've been following the Madoff cases.
Yeah.
A number of those mega banks who were sued by the trustee didn't want the bankruptcy court to hear those cases because there's a perception, whether it's true or not, I don't know, frankly, that bankruptcy judges tend to be more debtor friendly. And so they file motions, which is to what's called withdraw the reference. In other words, to have a district court decide its cases, and those motions were challenged and they were actually granted. So now a lot of the big banks are before the Southern District of New York as opposed to the bankruptcy court, fighting it out with the Madoff trustee.
Can you tell us a little bit about this case that you handled that went before two juries?
Sure. So what our case was against an individual who had a very wealthy guy who had run a bunch of telecom and internet and cable companies in the Virgin Islands and the Caribbean. He got into trouble and got sued over a going private transaction that occurred in the early 2000s. Eventually, a major judgment was entered against him and his companies. That sort of spiraled into bankruptcies being filed by both him individually and his companies. Once we got involved on behalf of the trustee, we started to investigate a number of transfers that were made by him, transfers of money and property, real estate, artwork, wines, fine wines, I mean millions of dollars of assets transferred from him to his wife. We contended for the purposes of avoiding his creditors. And so we brought a fraudulent transfer claim. Again, initially in the bankruptcy court, it was removed or transferred to the district court. A jury trial was sought, and it was tried for 1 week to a jury. The trustee for the companies brought a similar action, and because the facts were sort of overlapped, they were tried also at the same time to two separate juries. So.
And so, you know, having done this, I mean, you know, do you think there'll be a lot of other opportunities to take on something like this, or is it so rare that, you know, this is kind of a once in a lifetime deal?
Yeah, well, I sure hope so, because candidly, there's a number of people, bankruptcy lawyers, I don't consider myself a bankruptcy lawyer. I'm a litigator as a focus in bankruptcy. And bankruptcy lawyers tend to be very comfortable in bankruptcy court and don't want to think about going before jurors. There are a lot of benefits to trying that we found in front of a jury. I'll give you just a quick example. You know, bankruptcy courts have heard the story hundreds of thousands of times, right? So they don't get too jazzed up if someone's trying to hide assets from his creditors. But, you know, lay jurors very well may. So, again, it's the something that you want to think about. Now, in terms of whether or not there'll be opportunities, I think so, and mainly because of a very recent case that came out.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that from the Supreme Court.
That's correct, and that was the Anna Nicole Smith case. The second time it was up there was the case called Stern versus Marshall, and what happened there was the court found essentially that these bankruptcy judges, which are Article I appointed judges, not appointed through Article III, the judiciary branch, have more limited authority than everyone thought, candidly, to issue final judgments, final orders. And it remains to be seen how limited or how broad this holding is going to be. But I believe that it's going to lead to more opportunities to move cases out of the bankruptcy court into the district courts, and then associated with that, people can ask for juries. And again, you know, take the Madoff situation. I don't know if they'll ask for a jury, by the way, but I think I've been following it. It's an interesting issue. I mean, here you have presumably these all were, quote, victims of Madoff, right? And yet the trustee is suing them for to claw back, you know, millions of dollars of fictitious profits. Now, you know, would a jury be more sympathetic because they were the victims and they didn't know anything than a judge who says, well, you know, the law is the law? So I personally think there are going to be more opportunities, and I think there ought to be people ought to be thinking long and hard about whether or not to seek juries in the jury trials in the appropriate circumstances.
You know, and speaking of bankruptcies and in your background, you're an adjunct professor at Temple's University Law School. And in what you do in terms of your practice, I mean, is there anything that law schools can be doing differently to prepare future attorneys as it relates to bankruptcy issues?
Sure. I mean, it's a great question, and I think I kind of fell into this. Your last caller spoke about being more of a generalist, and it's interesting because I sort of fell into this about 10 years ago, starting to focus on bankruptcy, and one of the things that I found was that there is a whole sort of area, sort of just a business, school kind of courses and things that you really need to have as a foundation, and it's very difficult without it. So, for example, just as simple as lawyers reading financial statements. There are a lot of seminars out there on how to read a financial statement if you're a lawyer, and you didn't go to business school. You focused on some other area. So I think particularly for bankruptcy, the focus on business, finance, those kind of courses would be tremendously helpful. The types of bankruptcies that the courts are seeing are really complex, so that would be helpful.
Well, awesome. Well, this has been great to talk with you, Sam, and get a little insight on this. Appreciate you taking the time to be on Pat and Boggs Capital Thinking Radio Show, and I hope you have a great Labor Day weekend.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mike. I appreciate the opportunity.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We'll be closing out this segment of Capital Thinking and be back with more in a moment. Thank you.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Well, welcome back to today's Capital Thinking Show. This is Mike Dino from the Patton Boggs Denver office, and I'm guest hosting for my colleague Kevin O'Neill today. And we are on our third segment where we have Jordan Kalman joining us today. Jordan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike.
Well, Jordan focuses his law practice on transnational projects and transactions, international agreements, public international law and policy, and corporate compliance. You got a lot going on there, Jordan.
I certainly do.
Excellent. I think, you know, today we're going to focus on the fact that attorney-client privilege is understood maybe one way here in the United States, and then when you got to go over our borders, you got to account for the fact that people view that in a different way. Give us a little sense of what you're dealing with when you're trying to advise a client relative to attorney-client privilege.
Sure. Just like you said, Mike, I mean, the attorney-client privilege rules here in the U.S. of A. are difficult enough to understand. But when you start dealing with trans-border issues, the, you know, movement of people and capital and ideas across borders, you really get into some complicated issues. And, you know, let's just take a hypothetical. Let's just say that tomorrow you're the chairman of your firm or your supervisor said, hey, you know what, Mike, you're going to China. We've got a big investigation going on. You need to go over to China and you need to interview some witnesses and, you know, be sure and prepare and everything. And so you've never been to China before. You're very excited about it. So you grab your BlackBerry, you grab your laptop, everything's fine and dandy. You go on this long flight. You're combing through these files and so on and so forth. Well, when you get to China, you land, and as soon as you land in Beijing, you see this huge Starbucks, and you think, hey, man, it's just like home. Well, as you come through immigration, everything's fine, then you come through customs, and the Chinese customs officer says, hey, what have you got there? You say, well, I've got my BlackBerry and my laptop. Yeah, well, give it to me. Are you kidding me? This thing's chock full of secrets. Yeah, give it to me, and give me your password as well.
Jeez.
You're sitting there thinking, no, this is not happening. And so you refuse. And they say, well, let me just put a real fine point on it, Mike. You either turn loose of that stuff, give me your password, or we're going to arrest you. Well, you can't really use your telephone, so you're going to give it up. So you give it up. Ultimately, you get the thing back. It's been imaged, and all your secrets have been breached. And so, you know, a lot of my clients will take a brand new laptop, a brand new BlackBerry when they travel overseas, especially to jurisdictions, you know, that have the police state or that have people who can swarm in and grab your stuff, which is just about any country. And so let's just take the flip side of that. Let's just say now you did your job, everything's fine and dandy, now you're coming back to the U.S. of A. And so you're flying back to Reagan National or your local airport, and you're weary from travel, just like all of us have been from time to time. So you come in, and now you land, and you go through immigration. Everything's just fine. Now you come up to U.S. Customs. Customs officer says, hey, what have you got there? You say, oh, that's my BlackBerry and my laptop. Really? Well, turn loose of that. I want to see it. Are you kidding? Now you're feeling kind of cocky because you're on your home turf.
Yeah. Right?
So you say, no, I'm not going to give that to you. That's got attorney-client secrets on it. Well, let's see. I'm a customs agent. Customs can inspect anything that comes into the U.S. of A. That's a thing, and we're going to inspect it. And so this exact situation happened at DFW Airport about a year and a half ago. It had to do with a criminal investigation, and the U.S. Department of Justice had asked Customs to inspect some certain things that were coming into the country. And so here, you know, in that situation, you can say, hey, this is attorney-client privilege. I want special handling procedures, that type of thing. But the point that I make, initially is you got to be careful with what you're taking around the world, and you can't get too careless in terms of taking client secrets and not giving it a second thought. My mother always taught me you can never be misquoted in a letter, which is a great saying, and I'll tell you that I've lived by that. But when you're dealing with attorney-client secrets, sometimes it's best not to have all that stuff in writing. And, I tell my clients, one of my favorite quotes is by Tip O'Neill, former Speaker of the House, and he says, never write what you can speak, never speak what you can wink.
Explain to our listeners, what is the basis for attorney client privilege as we know it in this country? Why does it exist?
Well, the attorney-client privilege exists so that you can get candid comments from your clients, and your clients can know that they can go for confidential help that you can't even be compelled to reveal what they have told you. There are certain exceptions to it, but the attorney-client privilege is one of those things that is sacrosanct in our law. And the thing that many lawyers and clients don't get about the attorney-client privilege is that courts don't like the attorney-client privilege, right? It's a privilege to be a...
They'd just as soon not have that around.
Well, the thing is that the courts want open and full discovery. And so when you're asserting the attorney-client privilege, you have to assert it affirmatively or else, it is waived. You have to assert it. And so the courts will always examine it to say, you know, let's test it to see if it is indeed, a valid privilege. So it's just something to seriously think about.
And are there other countries that have similar protocols we do, or are we unique in how we have attorney-client privilege?
Well, the answer is both. Our privilege law is based on the common law, and of course, just about every state constitution, one of the first things that each state does is adopt the English common law. And so, as far as common law jurisdictions go, the attorney-client privilege around the world in common law jurisdictions would look similar to the U.S. privilege. But when you get into civil law jurisdictions, things change. Things change very dramatically. And for me, the best teaching case is the John Deere case. And listen to this, and I'm sure that you and some of your listeners could relate to this, but here's what happens. This is back in 1984, and here's the baptism by fire on attorney-client privilege. John Deere has a very well-respected lawyer in the U.S. They need a European general counsel. So they come to this guy, and they say, hey, look, would you like to go to Germany and be our European general counsel? You know, who wouldn't want that? You know, a lot of adventure and so on and so forth. So he goes over there, and one of the things he discovers while he's in Germany is that there are a lot of antitrust issues going on. And so this guy, does some internal investigation and writes some self-critical analysis, right, saying, hey, look, we may have some antitrust issues. And he sends that information to the board, not only in Germany, but back here in the U.S. of A. Well, about that time, the European Commission decides that they're going to target John Deere for some anti-competitive behaviors. So they do what's called a Dawn Raid, Mike. A Dawn Raid is where the European Commission antitrust authorities come in and raid your business. And it happens more and more frequently, not only in Europe, but around the world, and even sometimes simultaneously around the world. Well, they come in, and they tell this guy, we're taking your file cabinet, we're taking everything you've got. He says, wait a second, I'm an attorney. They say, no, you got to understand something. In Europe, there is no in-house attorney-client privilege in antitrust matters.
Jeez.
And so here's this guy. So they seize all of his documents, all of his self-critical analysis, and his memos are quoted in the legal opinion assessing exemplary damages against John Deere, saying you knew about these violations and you continued to do them. And so, you know, that's one of those things that a lot of people don't know, and it's recently been affirmed that there is no in-house counsel attorney-client privilege in antitrust matters, and that may extend beyond antitrust.
And this case that I heard about, it's Atsco Noble Chemicals?
Yes, that's the Axo case. Yeah, that's the one that that's just recently been decided. But basically what happened in Axo, it's a similar case to John Deere, Mike. It's mm-hmm. it's very similar. This guy was an in-house competition lawyer. He was in the UK. He was licensed to practice in the Netherlands. And the antitrust authorities decided to target these particular large makers of paints, which is what Akzo Nobel does. And so they raid the office, they take his emails and so on and so forth, and of course they're screaming attorney-client privilege. Now, earlier in the conversation you were asking me about the attorney-client privilege in the U.S., and certainly it's very similar to that in England. All right, this guy's in England.
Okay.
So you're thinking, wait a second, there is attorney-client privilege in England. The problem is that this is not English law. This is not British law. It's European-wide law on antitrust.
Oh.
And so ultimately, the court said there is no in-house counsel attorney-client privilege for in-house counsel on antitrust matters.
And so, in terms of having to advise clients, one of the things, technology is constantly evolving, and now we're talking about cloud computing and using your example early on, where you show up in China with a computer. I mean, are clients looking for ways to get around the traditional way of carrying data?
Oh, they certainly are, and when that data is housed in Europe, right, in the in-house counsel's office, that's trouble.
Yeah.
If you have a server that's centrally located for convenience in one of the European jurisdictions, you may have some serious problems when those antitrust authorities come in and seize your server.
So is it best to store all your, if there's cloud computing, to take advantage of data centers in the United States?
Yes, that doesn't completely solve the problem, because let's just say that those antitrust authorities come into the general counsel's office and they say, we want all the documents that you have here or that you have access to. So when that lawyer says, yeah, I can get access to everything because I have all this attorney-client privileged information in the U.S., I have a password and I can grab it, they may ask that lawyer to turn loose of that password and give them access to it.
Mm. Wow. And so you really got to think through carefully how to protect yourself if someone would come up in another in another country.
Absolutely right.
Do you think that other there will be any type of international protocols established to improve upon this type of privilege?
Well, I saw a poster the other day, Mike, and it said other cultures are not failed attempts at being us, right? Because we think we're right. We're Americans. Come on, of course we're right. But the problem is the rest of the world doesn't think that, and they think us arrogant when we say those types of things. And so there is talk about having some reciprocal treaty, but it is not going to happen in my lifetime. I promise you it won't.
Okay.
There's too many moving parts, too many politics.
Well, listen, we'll leave it at that, Jordan. We hope that, maybe in your lifetime something does change. But as for today, we're going to conclude this segment with Capital Thinking. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
All right, take care. We'll be back in just a moment with our final segment on Capital Thinking.
the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business,
you'll find the experts here.
Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Well, welcome back to Capital Thinking. We're live from Denver today. This is Mike Dino from the Patton Boggs Denver office, overlooking the city of Denver on the 49th floor in what is now the CenturyLink Tower. We used to be the Quest Tower, but CenturyLink from Louisiana bought Quest, and so they changed the name. And I'm guest hosting for my colleague from Washington, Kevin O'Neill, today. My next guest is Matt Needler. Matt is a former state legislator from west of Denver in Lakewood, and he is one of my colleagues here in the Denver office, one of my fellow policy advisors. Matt, welcome today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you could be on. We haven't had you on in a while to talk about Colorado politics, and, you know, like all the other states, we've got our redistricting going on with our congressional districts, and talk a little bit about what we got going on here in Colorado and how it kind of is similar to what's playing around the nation.
Well, yeah, it has been an interesting decade since the last time, the decennial census was completed and congressional districts get moved around from state to state. In 2001, Colorado added a congressional district, the 7th congressional district, giving us a total of 9 electoral votes instead of 8. And fast forward to 2008, President Obama won by, I believe, 365 electoral votes nationwide. If he won the same states today that he won in 08, if he won the same states in next year's presidential election, because of the redistricting, congressional reapportionment from states that that perhaps lost population or stayed even while other states grew, he would have 7 fewer electoral college votes. So, or maybe
but that wouldn't be the end of him.
That would not be the end of him, but it does. You know, I mean, it, and here in Colorado, as you said, there's a bit of a microcosm there. There's over the last 10 years, all of Colorado has grown and prospered, but at the same time, several Republican areas have grown faster than perhaps some of the Democratic strongholds in the state. So, in districts such as the 4th Congressional District, which has swung back and forth several times in the last 10 years. It's currently held by freshman Republican Cory Gardner. And then in the 3rd Congressional District, which is also, which quickly swung in the Democratic direction, in the last decade and then has swung back this last year with the Republican tide in Congress, bringing in, freshman Scott Tipton. Those two areas, especially in the 4th Congressional, Cory Gardner's district, has seen growth in some Republican counties. So this year, Colorado does not add a congressional district, but they do have to rejigger the maps to accommodate for the changes in population. All seven districts, of course, have to have the exact same population. So legislators tried to get the job done according to the U.S. Constitution through the legislative process. But we have a narrow Republican majority in the State House of Representatives and a Democratic majority in the State Senate, so they couldn't reach an agreement, although they tried very hard. And now the case is in court. I believe the hearings begin in early October.
And they'll have to come to a decision by the end of the year, correct?
That's right. They got to reach a decision by the end of the year, and then there's a lot of additional things. It really, you know, when I'm sure this is the case in every state. When you change a congressional district, you change a lot of other things that are affiliated with congressional districts. Certainly, you know, Colorado state government, we have numerous boards and commissions and decision-making trees based on representatives from each congressional district. By the way, it's interesting, the Democrats have just submitted their map to court. Republican maps have basically just slightly tweaked the districts that have been in place for the last 10 years, which of course everybody points out is ironic because they fought those were very widely considered Democratic maps 10 years ago. Now Republicans have a 4-3 majority in the congressional delegation, so they're happy to defend essentially the districts that they have today. Whereas Democrats, of course, have found that, you know, these districts need to change if they're going to improve their chances to get a majority in the congressional delegation. So they've submitted a map that really dramatically changes some of the congressional districts, and a couple of their top candidates for these, especially these freshman Republican seats, the challengers that they're running, may or may not be within, the districts that they're drawing. And I'm thinking specifically of Senate President Brandon Schaefer, who lives in, northern Boulder County here in Colorado. The Democratic map does not include that part of, Boulder County in the 4th Congressional District where he's already announced he's running. So.
Well, yeah, and that's an interesting thing here. We do have some folks who've already announced that they're challenging the Republican incumbent congressman, but they may not end up in that district when it's all said and done. And I've talked to several Democrats in the last few days, and they really don't know where things are going to end up.
I mean,
there's some hopefulness that the court, the legal precedent will favor the Democrats, but nobody sure it does.
Yeah, when I first described this process maybe 9 months ago, I said it was about five parts politics, one part legal precedent, and one part just basic population shifts. And now, of course, that it's in the courts, it's almost entirely legal precedent and probably some politics. People certainly want to double-check, you know, which judge was appointed by which governor, and certainly the state Supreme Court leans in a Democratic direction, so the assumption has been that the Democrats could fare well as they did 10 years ago when the case went to the courts. But
well, Matt, we have a little less than a minute. So,
sure.
of the Republican candidates for president who've declared and are still in the race,
right.
Which one do you think Colorado might pine toward the most?
Well, they overwhelmingly chose Mitt Romney in 2008. Most of the Republican establishment has gotten behind Governor Romney for this election year. I would say he still has the tailwind, but a lot of interest certainly in Rick Perry, who's just announced, and Michelle Bachmann. When I was a delegate to the Republican National Convention, and I was surprised at this very strong turnout of Ron Paul supporters in that convention process. So here in Colorado, so you know, a lot of you know, the grassroots is just kind of starting to get organized behind candidates, and I think we'll see a lot more changes in the next 2 months.
Well, Colorado certainly seems to bode well for getting a lot of attention. George Will just recently wrote about our governor, John Hickenlooper, and of course the governor is pointing out how we're a purple state, and we'll be quite in play for the presidential next year. So, Matt, thanks for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This concludes our Capital Thinking Show from Patton Boggs for this week. Thank you for joining me, Mike Dino, and our guest today, and have a great day from Denver, Colorado. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.